Is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Wednesday, July 6, 2022, and today will be better than yesterday. Producing from his home studio in the foothills of Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, working from a hotel in Atlanta, where tonight we will broadcast the Cardinals against the Braves. And Sarah Abbott is in Bristol, and she's a little chapped. Like, we're going in, Sarah, today. Like, you want a piece of Todd Radom over the weekly quiz.
Yes, I have receipts. I have proof that I had 4 wins going into this week. 4.
Okay, we're going to present the evidence coming up to Todd Radom and see what he says, because he is the chief executive of the weekly quiz. All right, last night, future Hall of Famer Max Scherzer was back on a major league mound in Cincinnati, and he was ridiculous.
0-2. Swing and a miss. Strike 3. Outstanding performance by Max Scherzer tonight. His 11th strikeout. His season high.
Wayne Randazzo on WCBS with that call. So Max Scherzer, 11 strikeouts in 6 innings, but the Mets offense could not score. And so this is how the game ended.
Reds will take a win any way they can get it. The 2-1 pitch. Breaking ball ripped center field, going back on it, the center fielder Nimmo, he makes the catch. Pham will tag and score, and the Reds walk it off on the sac fly to center field by Mike Moustakas.
That from 700 WLW. Scherzer was great. He spoke with reporters after the game about his outing.
Felt great. No issues whatsoever today. Felt strong. All the way through, never tightened up on me, so that's a good thing.
Aside from the health and obviously the types of results you got tonight, what were you happiest with in your first game back?
That I was able to locate the fastball then, but most importantly, really felt like I had a really good slider tonight. My rehab starts, my slider really wasn't sharp, it wasn't breaking the right way, and over this turn, you know, my bullpen really, I thought I found something on my slider that I knew I was going to need against this team, and was able to execute that and make that adjustment, and I felt like that pitch really helped me navigate their lineup tonight.
Steve Gelb's asking the questions for SNY. By the way, the Reds are going to be right in the middle of the trade market coming up. Jeff Passan's going to tell you how. Meanwhile, in Atlanta, the Braves beat up on the Cardinals.
It's 2-2 pitch on the way, and it's lifted to right and deep, retreating Capel at the wall, and it's gone into the top house. 2-run home run to the opposite field for Riley, and it's 3-1 Braves.
On the way to a 7-1 win, that from 680, the Fan. Atlanta now just 2.5 games behind the Mets. The guy who should probably start the All-Star game for the National League was back in action.
1-2 to Stassi. Got him swinging. Number 10. 100 miles per hour. Sandy Alcantara into double digits and strikeouts for the 8th time in his career, for the 2nd time this season.
That was Glenn Geffner, 940 WINZ, and Sandy spoke after the game.
He said one of them, you know, but I think all my games being really good, you know. I think my consistency that I've been doing, you know, just went outside every 5th day, you know, fighting for my team. I think that's really good.
The Ones Who Get It Done is brought to you by Grainger. For the Ones Who Get It Done, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, backed by 24/7 support and access to product specialists. Call, click Grainger.com, or stop by. Bryce Harper has 3 pins in his left thumb, a cast on his left hand, but he expects that he will be back. He spoke with reporters on Tuesday.
I'll be back.
I'll be back.
You know when? I don't right now, but I'll be back. I don't want to hope or think about anything. I just want to, you know, go day by day and be back when I can, whenever I feel healthy, whenever that is, to be able to help this team win. You know, if we're in it, if we're out of it, I'm going to come back and play no matter what, just so I know that I can, you know, go out there and play the game. I don't want that to be my last day playing, you know, this year, that game in San Diego. So no matter what the outcome, I'm going to come back and I'll be playing. So, you know, I can assure myself that I can go out there and play the game, you know, at a high level that I want to.
And the Phillies won that game. By the way, Bryce Harper sounding a lot like the Terminator.
I'll be back.
Yep, and he's that potent in what he brings to the Phillies lineup. Red Sox manager Alex Cora gave good news on the team's injury front, telling reporters that Chris Sale scheduled to pitch a five-inning minor league rehabilitation start today. Nathan Eovaldi also making progress. So the addition of starting pitchers could help the Red Sox bullpen with the dominoes falling in that direction. The Orioles and Rangers played a wild game last night. Baltimore was down to its last out when this happened.
Here's a pitch. He swings. Deep fly ball. Right field. Calhoun is back. Rougned Odor against his former team has just tied this one up. Two outs. Bottom of the ninth. Don't count out the Orioles just yet.
Yeah. Taylor, you would agree with me. If you're going to hit a home run, that's what it should sound like. Play that sound again about Odor's home run, because that was a bomb.
Here's a pitch. He swings.
How about that, Taylor? Would you agree with me? Like, oh, that was a crack of the bat.
Oh, yeah. And I know there were only like 7,000 fans at Camden Yards last night, but all 7,000 were going bananas as soon as that the ball hit the bat there.
Well, they're going bananas again in the 10th inning because this happened.
The 0-1 from Moore. Line drive to the gap in left center, and that's down. Cedric has done it. In comes McKenna, and the Orioles have walked it off again. It caps off a wild one in downtown Baltimore.
The Astros survived a slugfest with the Royals, and of course, Yordan Alvarez was right in the middle of it.
2-1 is hit in the air, deep to left center. It sends back Benintendi onto the warning track in front of the visitor's bullpen, and it's gone. Just into the Landry's Crawford boxes for Yordan Alvarez's 25th home run of the year. And the Astros' lead is 9-6.
Robert Ford, KBME, 790 AM. With that call, the Astros, because the Yankees were shut out by the Pirates last night, the Astros now only 4.5 games behind the Yankees for best record in the major leagues. Taylor, what else you got?
Buster, another day, another podcast with ESPN in partnership with Peyton Manning's Omaha Productions. We're talking Courtside Club today. Grab your popcorn and sit courtside with host and influencer Rachel DeMita as she chats with the biggest athletes, celebrities, influencers, and creative minds. Rachel and her guests dive into sports, pop culture, and the experiences that made them who they are today. That's Courtside Club. You can listen to that wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you did not catch yesterday's episode quite yet, or you want to revisit it, either way is fine. Check out Buster and Tim rapping on ESPN's YouTube page. And when I say rapping, not like actually rapping, just talking about the weekend's action, but it's a great watch. We do it every week, generally on Mondays. Yesterday it was Tuesday. So again, ESPN's YouTube page, Buster, Tim, check it out.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes. The clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, 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 with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code BASEBALL. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
Jeff Passan covers baseball for ESPN. Jeff, how you doing this week?
I'm doing great, Buster. How are you?
I'm doing okay because we're not so close to the trade deadline. I'm starting to feel that adrenaline begin to kick in when the you know, it's the first day of July. You're like, oh my God, it's right around the corner.
Yeah, except it's been a little odd because it's August 2nd this year, which we've had July 31st. Burned into our heads for so long, and then it's July 30th last year, and now it's August 2nd, and it's bouncing around. I understand. It's taken me a little while to get used to, like, those extra 48 hours might kill me.
Well, the trade deadline kills us every year, right?
Fair point.
And the turns and that's it feels like there's like this mountain of stuff that's going to happen here in the next month, but we're sort of in a calm right now. Within that, today you had a story posted on ESPN.com about the state of starting pitching around the majors. What did you learn?
It's grim, and it's not grim because of the starters themselves. It's grim, I think, because of what's expected of them, because of this evolution that we've seen in baseball that really has been going on for upward of 100 years now. I mean, you have to look back at what was expected of the starter in the 1920s into the 1960s. But I think there have been two sort of seminal moments that have changed it. And that was really in the 80s when the expectation to complete games was not it faded away a little bit as arm injuries became more prevalent, as Tommy John surgery became something that more and more pitchers had. But really, if you look back at 2013, there was a 5-man rotation at that point, and guys were throwing 200 innings, less than they had in the past, but still doing it. And then a story came out on Baseball Prospectus by Mitchell Lichtman, and it talked about the times through the order penalty. And teams had realized that, you know, longer a pitcher goes through a game, the less effective he tends to be. But I'm not sure that a lot of people in baseball understood just how stark that actually is. And what used to be something that if you're a starter not going through the lineup for a third time, you absolutely failed. Teams now looked at, like, if you're a starter going through a lineup the third time, we've failed. We haven't put our team in the best position to win. And when that happens, starting pitching innings absolutely cratered to the point where they are now. The average start in the big leagues is 5.15 innings. The average start in the minor leagues is 4.23 innings. And we've been left in this position where less and less is being asked of starting pitchers who have been in baseball's past the marquee attraction of games. How often anymore, Buster, do we look at a starting matchup and feel like this is an event? It's just not there because the de-emphasis of the starting pitcher has been so stark.
And so when we had a conversation about service time manipulation, you know, privately with folks, with baseball executives. It was amazing because they would run through the rationale off the record because no one would acknowledge it on the record. They would run through the rationale and then I'd say, well, how do you feel about it? And a lot of them would say, I hate it. And I get the same reaction to this trend with starting pitchers where it's like, okay, you know, I understand that the idea of running out all these relievers and not counting on starters as much. How do you personally feel about it? And what I get back all the time from folks who grew up as baseball fans like you and I did, they can't stand it. What type of reactions did you get from people in the sport about this?
Pretty strong ones. People have really, really strong opinions on this. And what it comes down to ultimately, and this is a battle that other sports are facing as well, it's efficiency versus entertainment, right? So you look at the NBA and organizations realized the three-point shot was undervalued. It was undervalued because if you went and made one, let's say you shoot 33% from three-point range, that's the equivalent of shooting 50% from two-point range. And teams are a lot likelier to shoot 33% from three than 50 from two. And so they started taking more threes. And it changed the dynamics of the game. It was a completely different game that fans had to adjust to. In baseball, I think with the starting pitcher, it's even more stark because, one can argue that there is something majestic about these super relievers who have been bred coming into games and throwing 100 with these filthy breaking balls and, you know, making Pitching Ninja the Twitter star that he is, and that there's something beneficial to the relievers. But at the same time, I think Theo Epstein makes the most impassioned argument about this and has a solution that I think is pretty elegant, frankly. And he looks at it like these are the protagonists of baseball games. Starting pitchers are the ones through whom the stories of the games can be told if they're allowed to tell them. But the problem is that organizations have prioritized that efficiency, that desire to win games, because that is their mandate. If you're a GM and you do not win, Buster, you get fired. So while in their hearts, they want to go back to how things were, in their heads, they say, why would I ever go back there if I found something that's more effective? And, you know, I was talking with one general manager and he said something to the effect of, I'd love to do it. I think it would be great for the game. Just wait until I'm not a GM anymore.
And I don't know who that is that you spoke with. It could be Eric Neander, who's the, you know, head of baseball ops for the Rays.
It could be a lot. It could be a lot of guys. Listen, right. Like that opinion is not unique.
No, but I was going to say, because the Rays, how could you possibly argue with their success? Right. Yeah. And the way they've run their pitching staff, they've been unbelievable going up against these financial giants in the American League East, toughest division in baseball. And on the other hand, I don't know how you feel, but you sit down and you're looking at a number of games to watch. And I'm like, I like watching the seven relievers that I'm not going to know in 4 years. That's the part that I think that Theo is talking about. Like, you need those guys to be the Hulk Hogans of the sport, you know, the absolute stars of the sport. And while there's a lot of sentiment for it, I find this issue to be a lot like a lot of other issues in baseball, where there might be general agreement that the sport could use some change in it. I just don't know what that engine of change is going to be. I thought it might be the union. I actually had a union official come up to me last year and ask, hey, to give me a pressing issue going into these contract negotiations. And I said, you guys got to find a way to restore the preeminence of starting pitchers. And it's not only, you know, good for the sport to have those superstars, the Madison Bumgarners, the Sandy Koufax, you know, the Clayton Kershaws, but it also helps the union. And I was a little bit surprised that there wasn't more push from within the union to do that, because, as you know, those guys have, for a lot of years, have been the standard bearers about where salaries are on the pitching side. Yep.
No question. I think part of that is, frankly, what the rank and file numbers have become. Yes. There are more relief pitchers than there are starting pitchers. And the easiest way to change this, frankly, is by getting rid of pitchers. And that's what Theo Epstein proposes, having a cap of 11 pitchers on every active roster. And what that would do is multifold. Not only would it force starting pitchers to prioritize going deeper into games, by prioritizing going deeper into games, you wouldn't be able to go max effort on your stuff. Not going max effort and throwing more strikes and trying to induce contact would put ball in play more, so you would have more action. You know, you would see a return of a lot of the principles that are going to dovetail with no shifts, which are going to be gone. And having this all sped up by the pitch clock, it's going to be difficult to go max effort every time anyway. So I understand it would be a wildly different game. It already is going to be a different game next year. But the notion that pitchers cannot adapt back to what they once were because they've tasted the sweet, sweet nectar of max effort pitching and of elite spin and of 25 plus inches of carry on a fastball high in the strike zone. I mean, you have all of these things that they've fallen in love with. How about they fall in love with complete games? We have, and I'm sorry, I know I sound like an old man here, but what happened, Buster, is that in an effort to try and keep pitchers healthy. Baseball peeled back and back and back on what it asked of its pitchers, what it asked of its starters. We went from a four-man rotation to a five-man rotation. We went from 150 pitches a game, which admittedly is absurd, to 120, which really isn't necessarily, to 100 and even below now. And what have we found? Injuries are no better. They're not. $100 million-plus dollars already have been lost to arm injuries on the injured list this year, and billions in the past. And the reason that guys aren't staying any healthier is because they didn't replace fewer pitches with less stress and strain. They just changed the way that they pitched. And so the combination of the max effort pitching with the fewer pitches has led to these one-inning burst guys that you see now who come in, have this goofy stuff, and don't have to do something like, you know, navigate a lineup three times through.
And so many of those guys are winding up in the injured list because they're like the, you know, they're like the Lamborghini that's redlining and then breaks down. And they don't wind up lasting, but they are, it's amazing.
Here's the thing, Buster, we don't need a bunch of Honda Accords. That's not what this is arguing. I think that there can be, I'm not much of a car guy, but I think there can be like Mercedes AMGs, like classy, and yet under the hood, there is some thunder. And it's gonna be there for you and be strong and take you a long way.
There's a lot of need of that type of guy in the trade market. I think you would agree with me as I make my transition to what we're going to talk about before.
Elegantly done.
Thank
veteran
you.
Podcast host.
Before we get to August 2nd, give me a team in your eyes most in need of a deal to augment a part of their team. I have a clear number one in my mind. What about you?
Oh, boy. You know, is it bad that I'm sticking in the... This may not be a team that ultimately is a huge threat to win a World Series, but the Minnesota Twins need a starting pitcher in the worst kind of way. They just keep running through guys, whether... it's Chris Paddock, Chris Archer now on the injured list. And I think the Twins have a lot of the elements in place to be a dangerous team in October. But they need that starting pitcher. And I don't know if it's Frankie Montas. I don't know if it's Luis Castillo, but they need that bigger name guy.
I got the St. Louis Cardinals. When I look at their everyday lineup, look at their bullpen, their defense, the depth, all those young players they're trying to integrate, they clearly have a surplus of guys. They are in a position to make a deal, and who knows about Frankie Montas. And by the way, you and I, a lot of times, you know, you wait for information on these injuries. He left the game on Sunday.
Still don't have MRI results.
Yeah, they're apparently the results are only being sent out there by horse and buggy. Because you know that they probably have a pretty good idea what's going on, but other teams are waiting to see because he was perceived to be the potential number one. If I'm the Cardinals, I'm even calling the Reds, who probably are not predisposed to talking with you about Luis Castillo in some kind of deal, but they need that guy. They need a number one type guy, number two type guy, so that not only, you know, perhaps run down the Brewers in the National League Central, but also to be a threat in what feels like a superpower postseason in the National League.
And it would be interesting if the Cincinnati Reds were, and listen, the Cincinnati Reds are a team that has approached Luis Castillo in the past with contract extensions, that has tried to get Tyler Mahle locked up. What would happen if Luis Castillo were off the market? I don't know that that's going to happen necessarily, because he is so clearly at this point the number one guy. But if he were to be taken off the market, what do some of these teams do in terms of starting pitching to help themselves? Like, is there anybody out there who's a real difference maker and game changer?
No. You know, the type of guy that I think a lot of people, you know, that see might become available, be like guy like Kyle Hendricks, but even he went out of the game last night.
Shoulder last night. Yeah.
So there is slim pickings, and you're right. You know, Twins would be a team that could use that guy. Cardinals for sure. I'm just going to throw teams at you. Give me 30 seconds on what you've heard, what you expect. Dodgers.
You know, as much as it looks like the Dodgers would want to prioritize their bullpen at this point because they've had a number of injuries and ineffectiveness from Craig Kimbrel, I'm not sure that they're going to be out there swinging the big deal. They always seemingly take a big swing in July at this point. I wonder if that is a starting pitcher, which is odd considering the starting pitching depth that they've had, but that's been chipped out by Walker Buehler's injury. You don't know what you're going to get from Kershaw. Now Chris Taylor's out. The Dodgers have a lot of ability to do a lot of things, but they're counting on Blake Treinen coming back, on Dustin May coming back, on Tommy Canely coming back, and they feel like there are enough reinforcements there bullpen-wise where that may not be the area they need it.
Yankees.
What do the Yankees really need? And that's sort of a rhetorical question. I know every Yankee fan is going to scream at me, a left fielder! And I get that. But if the Yankees stood pat, would that be the worst thing, Buster?
No, but I would say I look at Andrew Benintendi, the type of player that he is, the postseason experience that he has. You know, the fact that he puts the ball in play, gets on base. And I think in the short term as a rental, if I'm Brian Cashman, I'm doing what I can do to do that.
See, that's interesting because Andrew Benintendi is that very unique deadline player. Everyone wants him. I mean, the low payroll teams want him. The high payroll teams want him. The big markets want him. The small markets want him. When Andrew Benintendi goes, I think Kansas City, it better get an absolute haul for him because the interest is frankly just off the charts from everyone there. I've heard from teams, when I say big market, small market, everyone likes Andrew Benintendi. And, you know, the questions about him at this point are more, is he trying not to hit for power? And is he prioritizing and emphasizing average? And yeah, the answer is yes. I mean, playing in Kauffman Stadium is a different beast than other ballparks. And I think what you could see if Benintendi goes somewhere else is a return of the biceps and a little more pop depending on the stadium that he's playing. And if he's in Yankee Stadium, you know, I know he loves going the other way, but he could attack that short porch in right field as much as other left-handed hitters do.
Yeah, hitting over 300, 400 on base percentage almost. Yep. He's just been phenomenal. The Padres, always interesting, typically aggressive. You know, A.J. Preller's poking around.
Yeah, he's going to do something. And the Padres have such great starting pitching depth. You sit there and think, well, they're not going to do it. No, A.J. Preller's willing to move guys that you wouldn't think he would move and go after guys who you wouldn't think he would go after. And yet I look at the Padres and it feels like they need a bat. Like a Brian Reynolds would be perfect for them. I still don't think Brian Reynolds is going to move because I feel like the Pirates are maybe on the verge of something. They're not there yet. But with O'Neill Cruz, who looks at every bit the star that his tools say he can be, with Ke'Bryan Hayes, with Nick Gonzalez coming, with Jack Swinski having all that power in the outfield and Reynolds there with some pitchers on the verge as well. I don't know. Pittsburgh feels a little bit like where Kansas City is, which is that you need to start adding guys to this core that you have in place. And you need to start spending some money. So, you know, Preller loves to go for moonshots. And Brian Reynolds at this point feels like a moonshot. But if he's willing to give up CJ Abrams, you know, at that point, the Pirates have to at least listen. And he's been willing to give up top prospects in the past.
I'm fascinated by the decision the Orioles are facing, because they obviously, this has been a year of progress. They're playing better. They're nudging toward 500. And on the other hand, this is, they're playing in the American League East. There are probably four teams that are going to make the playoffs out of the East. Yep. The Orioles are almost certainly not going to be one of them. What do you do if you're the ownership and you feel like you're turning the corner and you have all these marketable players?
I got to say, I kind of dig watching the Orioles. You know, just some of the reclamation projects there. I've seen Jorge Lopez fail a number of places, and now he's throwing 99 with nasty breaking stuff in his first real full run at the bullpen. But I trade Jorge Lopez. You know, Trey Mancini is a superstar human being, and you know, a great addition to any clubhouse, and a leader in Baltimore, and someone who's been the paragon of consistency. And I probably trade him too, because the Orioles are getting to a point right now where I think they need to start running themselves like they're going to be here soon. Like all of these high draft picks, whether it's Adley Rutschman, Colton Cowser, you know, we've seen Heston Kjerstad come back finally. It's getting to the point where they have to start to try and win, and they're not there yet. So you remain, as long as the rules are in place here, you remain in asset building. Hate to say it, but not like they got a ton of fans turning out right now who they're going to scare off with this. And it's been a pretty grim situation there for a while. And frankly, you gotta see the plan through. But it's, we're getting close to nut cutting time there in Baltimore. Like they need to start trying to be competitive. We've had enough tankage going on for a franchise for a while.
I wonder about Cedric Mullins. I think he would be, for example, a great fit with the Astros. Like that, you know, you see where the Astros
interesting.
Are.
Interesting.
You know, there's. I gotta
be honest. I look at the Astros and I see Jake Meyers and Chaz McCormick and Jose Siri, and feel like among those three, they do a pretty reasonable job in center. Like it would be great to have a star at every position. You know, if you're Houston, would you not prefer either Contreras or Josh Bell? Because I understand the reticence of bringing in a new catcher at the trade deadline, especially with someone like Martin Maldonado, who's as respected as he is. Wilson Contreras is the best bat on the market, and you're going to need every little thing you can if you're the Astros to go out and beat the Yankees, and or to beat the Red Sox, or to beat the Twins, or to beat, you know, the Blue Jays. I don't know. Maybe Corey Lee takes that job. I sort of doubt it at this point. I just feel like Martin Maldonado is not a sensitive guy. If you're Dusty Baker and James Click, and you explain to him, we can get this guy who can win us a ring, how can he not say, let's go do it? Yuli Gurriel's been ineffective at first base this year. That to me, first and catcher is big a hole for the Astros as center field is.
Well, and I tell you what, you could get Contreras, and I've talked about teams along these lines, I'm sure you have too, where you bring him into a role where he's not necessarily just the primary catcher. Maybe he's actually catching a third of the games, certain starts. He's serving as a DH, maybe you teach him at first base. If you're the Astros, you're the team. Something, but he clearly was an upgrade offensively. I mean,
he's played the outfield too.
Right. Before we go, tell us where everything stands between Juan Soto and the Nationals, because that is a fascinating situation developing there.
Yeah, there's just such an interesting dynamic in that you've got these sides that are talking about one of the biggest contracts potentially of all time in professional sports, the most potentially new money for a contract in a baseball deal in history. And all of that is against the backdrop of the team being sold. And so if you are a potential owner, on one hand, you might want Juan Soto to stick around because you've got this star. You also might look at it like, why am I investing with a brand new $400 million plus dollar liability for which I am responsible? Yep. And I understand that, $400 million for Juan Soto is like market-ish. Not if you look at his numbers this year, but I always have faith in Juan Soto's ability to be a productive offensive player. So I think all of that will even out by the end of the year. But I'll tell you this, if he's hitting 320 as opposed to in the 220s, if he's getting on base, 48% of the time as opposed to around 40 where he's at now, it's a lot easier to up that number on the contract and sell it to this new owner and keep Juan Soto in Washington.
And I got to say that as we move along here, it's beginning to develop a little, it reminds me a lot of what happened with Manny Machado and the Orioles, and that they wound up selling him. You remember in his last year with the team and with the benefit of 2020 hindsight, we all knew they should have sold him before. And, yeah. And
but so, hey, the Orioles got Dean Kramer out of it.
All right, Jeff. Well, thanks for doing this.
Thank you, Buster.
For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers high-quality supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as access to product specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Plus, their commitment to being your safety partner can help you keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart?
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes!
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
Todd Radom is a chief executive of our weekly quiz. He's a graphic artist whose work can be seen on fields all across America, all around the world, or you can go to his website, toddradom.com. Todd, how are you doing this week?
I'm doing well, Buster. How about you?
I'm doing okay, but I must say, you are walking into a Jerry Springer moment. Confrontation!
Uh-oh.
But it's not about paternity. It's about wins and losses in the weekly contest, and Sarah Abbott is here to confront you with the results.
Todd,
go ahead, Sarah.
I have four wins. Four. I went back and I found them. Please reference episode Always About Urgency.
Okay.
Complete Hypothetical. Sarah Smile. An All-Time Tag Team. That's four.
I am going to, after we conclude here, and I will get back with you, with Buster, and with Taylor directly, I will consult what I am looking at here, which is my color-coded Excel spreadsheet. Now, I cannot account for human error. There is no, I will give you benefit of the doubt, but there's no Italian conspiracy here. There are no bursting water pipes. Again, we don't want to talk politics, but I promise to take a look, and I will not reference a score at the conclusion of today's quiz.
It's okay.
Until I have a recount.
You don't need to take a look. I have the audio files right
here. Oh my gosh.
She's got the goods.
I have it right now. I'll send it to Taylor to make it sound pretty, but.
So I think in fairness to Todd.
Oh, sorry. Carry on.
Wow.
I think in fairness to Todd, we'll give him a week to do his research. I mean, think of him as being like the Supreme Court in 2000, right? We're having a recount and he's going to go and ultimately decide. Oh, sorry. I just went down the road of politics, didn't I? Anyway, we'll let Todd do some research using the information that you sent along, Sarah. But you were on record as contesting the results of this election.
Yes. And I am confident. I am confident. I have the receipts. I have the proof. With that being said, I will probably get this week's question wrong, but that's okay because I have 4 wins.
And Taylor is quite nervous about this because he was feeling very comfortable in his place in the standings. And all of a sudden, Taylor feeling a little bit more fragile with the receipts now being presented by Sarah.
I knew this was coming. Sarah is a person of integrity and honesty, so I knew that there was probably some fire to the smoke that she was throwing out there. So I've been bracing for this, and here we are. That's arrived.
Well, we'll wait and see. Because Todd is the ultimate authority on this. And Todd also is a person of great integrity and great credibility. We'll just see where that goes.
I have a question, which may tip the balance of this conversation.
Yes.
If I am not mistaken, there have been a couple of weeks where Sarah has not been with us while we were doing this live. And it could well be that Taylor retroactively asked the question on my behalf. Is that the case?
Yes, there were some weeks that I was absent.
I yes. believe that we have solved the mystery. So I'm going to go back. I will do my due diligence. I will get my judicial robes on. But I am going to go out on a limb and say that we got to the bottom of things. But let's see what we get.
Wow. Okay. This means that Todd's going into the weekly quiz bylaws. Again, more research is needed to do. We'll have a ruling next week, Sarah. Do you accept that?
I accept it if it goes in my favor. And if it does not go in my favor.
Oh, so we are right back to politics, aren't we?
If it does not go in my favor, I'd like to bring it to the Court of Appeals and have listeners weigh in.
Oh, my goodness. All right, Todd, let's talk about this week's Phantom franchise.
So, Buster, the New York Giants, they were running on fumes by the mid-1950s. The Giants won the World Series in 1954. The following year, they averaged but 10,432 fans per home game. And the following year, 1956, the club finished in sixth place in the eight-team National League, and attendance plummeted by 24% on a year-over-year basis. The team finished last in the National League in attendance in both 1956 and 1957, averaging a little more than 8,000 fans per home game at the decrepit Polo Grounds, which Sports Illustrated called an antiquated museum. Giants owner Horace Stoneham began to discuss a team move as early as 1955. The Giants owned the AAA Minneapolis Millers and the territorial rights that came with them, and Metropolitan Stadium, a state-of-the-art Major League-ready ballpark, was being constructed on a 164-acre plot of farmland in Bloomington. The ballpark opened on April 24th, 1956, and the Giants and their farm team drew a sellout crowd to an exhibition game a couple of months later, which certainly opened Stoneham's eyes to the potential there. The Brooklyn Dodgers, meanwhile, were plotting a move of their own, and in early 1957, they entered into an agreement with the city of Los Angeles to transfer the Dodgers west. According to a March 1957 document, later released by the family of Brooklyn owner Walter O'Malley, Stoneham had, quote, made up his mind some time ago to move his franchise from New York to Minneapolis. It goes on to say, he told me that his decision was quite independent of anything Brooklyn might do. He is prepared to move for the 1958 season, end quote. By July, however, Stoneham said that he was weighing offers from Minneapolis, San Francisco, and Oakland, telling the Minneapolis Tribune, if Minneapolis has a better proposition than San Francisco, we will listen. O'Malley approached his longtime New York rival, Stoneham, asking him to consider the possibility of a dual move to the West Coast, with two clubs easing the travel situation for the National League's other team, none of which were situated west of St. Louis at the time. The Giants eventually finagled a deal that called for a new taxpayer-funded ballpark in San Francisco, with very favorable lease terms and a lot of parking. They became, of course, the San Francisco Giants. But today, Buster, we are celebrating the Minneapolis Giants, who are this week's forgotten franchise.
So I want to see if you agree with me on this. Horace Stoneham is kind of like the equivalent in baseball history to like Wally Pipp compared to Walter O'Malley's Lou Gehrig. Yes, it always feels like Horace Stoneham did the wrong thing.
He was there along for the ride. But Buster, there is this powerful narrative that has developed over the decades that the, you know, the Dodgers leaving Brooklyn and the Giants leaving Upper Manhattan, these were franchises that were ripped apart from the body of this city. And it always amazes me that attendance figures were down. The two ballparks really were falling apart. This is at a time when the neighborhoods that the ballparks were in were changing, certainly deteriorating in certain respects. So, you know, the West Coast looked pretty darn good. And when you've got the taxpayers footing the bill for a brand new ballpark, even if it was Candlestick Park, that's got to be an appealing thing, right?
Okay. So you're saying he was still a winner. You know, Wally Pipp was a big leaguer, right? He had a he had a good career in Horace Stoneham. And he moved on to a better deal. So I hear you. You were polite in pushing back. That was very nice of you. All right, let's do this week's quiz. We'll bring Sarah back into it. Sarah, are you ready to set aside the Discord and go forward with this week's quiz?
I am, and I will probably get it wrong. But I am ready.
As always, a 1 in 4 chance is the rule here. Before adopting their current nickname, this club was known as the Perfectos. Was it A, the Cardinals, B, the Dodgers, C, the Cubs, or D, the Guardians? Before adopting their current nickname, they were known as the Perfectos. Cardinals, Dodgers, Cubs, or Guardians?
Sarah, you want to go first? So you get on record for sure?
I have no confidence in this one, but Cardinals is my answer.
All right, Taylor.
I'll go Cubs.
I'm going B, Dodgers. It jumped into my mind right away, and if I'm wrong, I was badly wrong.
Well, I don't know much, but I do know that Sarah has prevailed because it was the Cardinals
who
in 1899 were known as the St. Louis Perfectos. So after we tally up what we tally up, we could have a horse race going on here.
That is 5 wins now.
Oh,
five.
Wow. No, not yet. Not yet. We'll wait and see. All right. Todd, before you go, tell me what you thought of the Padres City Connect uniforms.
Wow. Buster, you are colorblind, correct?
I am, and based on the response I saw to these on social media, I should be thankful that I am colorblind.
That's kind of what I was getting at. All right, two things. We separate the aesthetics from the market speak that surrounds the release of these City Connect uniforms when each and every one of them gets out there. So for those who are not familiar with them, they are a nod to the fact that San Diego is, of course, on the border of Mexico, that there is a huge Latino and Latina influence on the market. They are loud. Buster, they remind me a little bit, maybe a whole lot of, some people have said Arizona iced tea cans. I think they remind me of the Miami Heat, Miami Vice uniforms. So everything is going to remind everybody of something else. They are loud. I will say this. The Padres have existed for over half a century, and they have had many identities over the years. For them to have yet another one, loud or otherwise, it somehow seems appropriate. So bring it on. Manny Machado will look good in them. I would not look good in them. You would not look good in them.
Yeah, I saw Fernando Tatis Jr. likes the idea of the bucket hats along with those uniforms. Who knows where we are? By the way, I figured out why I immediately popped into mind that the Brooklyn baseball franchise referred to as the Perfectos, because they were at one point the Superbas.
Well, right? yes, the Brooklyn Superbas,
yes,
and the Bridegrooms as well. I don't think I'm giving any future answers. But to wrap it up, of that era, my favorite and the favorite of many, the Atlanta Braves of today were once known as the Boston Bean Eaters.
Oh man. All right. I look forward to next week. We have the hammers coming down, the gavels coming down from Todd, and Sarah awaits the answer. Todd, thanks for doing this.
All right, everybody. Thank you.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for a Wednesday. Nick Lurkins at Banker DJ Nick writes, and Monday's episode was great and filled with my Cardinals, but was there no mention of Arenado's weekend? Hits for the cycle one night, then has two home runs the next, one of which was part of their historic back-to-back-to-back-to-back first inning.
All right, Nick, thanks for getting our back. Yeah, we should have mentioned that. You're 100% right. You have now, so we got that covered.
Check that box. Last one for today, Mitchell at Tigers of Detroit writes, and I'm a little surprised that Ohtani is not brought up in the MVP debate more often. He has a 139 OPS plus, 147 ERA plus, and leads the AL in WAR per Baseball Reference. Did he set the bar too high for himself with last year's performance?
Yeah, Mitchell, we talked about on Friday's podcast. I talked about that with Jessica Mendoza. She still feels like Aaron Judge is the MVP. I do feel like unless Judge keeps up a ridiculous pace and goes over 60 homers, that Ohtani's going to run him down because he's adding value on both sides. And as we said over and over and over again last year, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., as great as he was, he just couldn't match that the production value. So I do think that Ohtani in the end is going to wind up winning the MVP.
Alrighty, that's it for Bleacher Tweets. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets while you're watching games. We will be back on Friday.
That's it for today. My thanks to Nick for stepping in and covering us for Monday's podcast. To Jeff, to Todd, Sarah, and Taylor. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something we need to fight against every single day.